Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
I have traveled this country from one end to another, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts.
The historic startup culture is astounding.
Everybody do your job.
And together we're going to make Boston even stronger.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Morody and Ann Mustu on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston.
U.S. stocks declined today and metals dropped in the Fed's aftermath. I'm Ann Mustu in the Bloomberg 106.1 newsroom in Boston's Financial District here with Peter Barnes. Coming up, we're talking to Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey on the state's lawsuit against Equifax. And former U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz will join us here in studio to discuss her new career as a private practice attorney and visiting professor at Boston College Law School. We will ask her about her high-profile cases, including Whitey Bulger and the Marathon Bomber. And it's officially symphony season. Mark Volpe, managing director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, will tell us what's ahead in the new season and a celebration of Lawrence native Leonard Bernstein. First, let's get a look at global markets with Peter Barnes.
That's right, Ann. Indexes down across the board today. The Dow Industrials falling 53 points to close at 22,359 after a nine-day winning streak. The S&P 500 fell about 0.3% to about 2,500. The NASDAQ down by about 0.5%, closing at 6,422. Apple was down sharply, losing about 2% of its value. It's now down to its lowest level since August 1st, Ann.
Thanks, Peter. And Bloomberg Boston Index today up 0.25% at 131.88. This report brought to you by Elbow Beach Bermuda, an oceanfront enclave of classic style and contemporary luxury. Go to elbowbeachbermuda.com for more details. Worth noting, Boston-based Cabot Corporation up 3% today, the highest level in nearly 3 months. The specialty chemicals and performance materials companies benefiting from news that its industry competitor, Calgon Carbon, has a buyout proposal. Calgon Carbon entered an agreement to be acquired by Tokyo-based Kirei at a 63% premium. And it's been a busy week for Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. She's suing Equifax for failing to protect the personal information of nearly 3 million state residents. And she's joining a coalition of 39 attorneys general in the United States investigating allegations of deceptive marketing by manufacturers of branded opioids and improper tracking and reporting by distributors. Earlier today, Peter and I spoke with Healey. Let's just start by asking you to talk about suing the credit reporting firm Equifax.
Sure. Well, we've sued Equifax because what they did was so brazen, so outrageous. In all of our years of experience looking at and investigating data breaches, we've never seen anything like this. Equifax failed to do what it's supposed to do to protect basic information, personal information. And as a result, their systems were exploited because they were vulnerable. And now millions and millions of folks across this country are at risk.
So what is the suit doing exactly? Is it looking for damages, for remediation, or what?
We're looking for Equifax to pay for their mistakes. They need to pay the price of making all of these customers whole out there, all of these people who've had their information basically exposed now and vulnerable to exploitation by criminals. And that means they need to pick up the tab for any and all efforts to protect against financial fraud and identity theft. They also need to pay a penalty, because we need to be clear that these credit reporting agencies need to do their job, take care of business, and safeguard information with the right systems and the right investments in place. And they need to fix the problem fundamentally. I think this really highlights some of the work that we need to do to reform the system, where you have these credit reporting agencies out there collecting vast amount of data and then selling that data on to others, which is okay. What's not okay is they're not protecting that data, they're not safeguarding that data, and people have been hurt. And with more that comes to light about this, I just continue to be shocked at how outrageous and really reckless Equifax has been with our information.
And you said this has affected 3 million residents of Massachusetts, is that right?
We believe up to 3 million residents here, 140 million Americans nationwide. And this is a really big deal, because basically by taking this information, leaving it out on the sidewalk essentially, exposing it to criminal elements that got in then and took this information, we've got millions of Americans across this country who are at risk now of identity theft and financial fraud. That's a terrible situation for folks to be in.
Again, we're speaking with Attorney General Maura Healey here in Massachusetts. We talk about how you're joining this wider probe into the opioid industry.
The opioid crisis, the opioid epidemic, is something that's ravaged families and communities around our country. And many of us have been actively working on and working at this issue. But what we have announced is that state AGs are coming together, AGs from rural states, from more urban states, Democrat, Republican, all of us working together to expand our office's investigations into opioid manufacturers and distributors to determine exactly what happened here and if their sales and marketing practices contributed to this crisis. So we've sought information and we need to get answers. The American public deserves answers, and we need to make sure that we take whatever steps are necessary to cut down on the proliferation of deadly and addictive pills, and that we take efforts to prevent this from happening to other families out there.
Attorney General Maura Healey, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time.
And analysts and plaintiffs' lawyers and others say that Equifax will probably have to pony up tens of millions of dollars to settle this case, which, as you know, nationally affected 143 million Equifax customers. But speaking of attorneys general, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in town today. He gave remarks this afternoon at Moakley Courthouse on cracking down on transnational criminal organizations such as MS-13. But he also discussed the opioid epidemic and crisis, and he mentioned the Boston Marathon bombings. Massachusetts politicians like Boston Mayor Marty Walsh have been critical of the Attorney General and the Trump administration on the travel ban, the immigration crackdown, sanctuary cities, and other issues.
Yeah. In other news today, more breaking news, quite a day for breaking news, Peter. Aaron Hernandez, the former New England Patriots tight end who committed suicide in April while serving a life sentence for murder, was found to have one of the most severe forms of CTE, the degenerative brain disease linked to repeated head trauma that's been found in more than 100 former NFL players. A lawyer for Hernandez, Jose Baez, announced the results at a news conference just about an hour ago, saying researchers determined it was the most severe case they had ever seen in someone of Aaron's age. He was 27 years old. He was acquitted on murder charges and hanged himself 5 days later.
We're also watching Hurricane Maria after we've had Hurricane Irma and Hurricane Jose. But whether or not it really hits us here in Massachusetts depends on whether or not it is it depends on a zombie hurricane. What's that story?
Yeah, so this is a story from our Boston reporter, Brian Sullivan, who covers extreme weather and the energy market. Hurricane Maria is continuing to move north, Peter, but whether the storm makes landfall again could be determined by the word zombie, which is what former Hurricane Jose is in meteorological vernacular, a once dangerous tropical storm that has fallen apart and been robbed of its brute force, but it can still have an impact. And they're saying that as Maria moves on from Puerto Rico and the other islands it was ravaging Tuesday and Wednesday, the remains of Jose will be hovering over the Atlantic Ocean. So we'll see. It's quite a week ahead.
I was talking to Brian about this, and it's because Jose could determine that could force the direction right of Maria one way or another. And as you just said, and so won't repeat what you just said, but hey,
no, but you're in.
The Red Sox.
Yes, the Red Sox.
All right. I am a new citizen of Red Sox Nation.
Welcome.
All right?
Welcome.
May I just declare that.
So have you moved over from the Nationals? Are you really doing that?
I was not a Nationals fan.
Oh, okay.
My formative years were in Philadelphia, and so I was a very frustrated Philadelphia sports fan over the years, but then traveled around, and you know, I followed the Nationals in Washington, D.C. while I was there. Great team. We'll see where they end up, but I am now officially a Red Sox fan. I have my Red Sox baseball cap from my son-in-law Sean and my daughter Maggie down in the South Shore, and I've been to some games and it's been very exciting. And they clinched their postseason berth, which is fantastic yet again. The other thing that happened in the game the other night was that Chris Sale, the ace pitcher, got his 300th strikeout as a Red Sox pitcher. And let me tell you, that is a very rare club indeed to be in, to get 300 strikeouts. Only I think he's among the 20 pitchers in the history of baseball to do that.
Have you been to Fenway Park yet?
Oh, yeah. I've
okay.
been to Fenway. been to Fenway with my grandsons and my son-in-law, and love Fenway. It is such an amazing historic ballpark, and just love. I look forward to going to many games at Fenway, and I'm also now a Patriots fan too. Got my Patriots hat as well now, Ann.
Good, that's great news. Every year Fenway Park changes a little bit. This year I went to see the new Tavern section, which is very cool. You buy a ticket to the tavern. Anyway, coming up, we have a great show ahead. Lots of live, good in-studio guests, including former U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, who's going to be talking about her new career as a visiting professor at Boston College Law School. We'll ask her about some high-profile cases, again, including Whitey Bulger and marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. I'm Ann Mostu in studio with Peter Barnes. This is Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West and on the South Shore.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1061 Boston.
Pretty good day for Boston businesses on Wall Street, even as U.S. stocks declined overall. I'm Ann Mostu here in the Bloomberg 1061 newsroom in Boston's Financial District here with Peter Barnes. And coming up, we're speaking live with former U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, who's going to be talking to us about her new career path and teaching and talking about some of her highest profile cases. First, let's take a look at global markets with Peter Barnes.
That's right, Ann, and we talked about the indexes, all of the major ones being down this trading day. But we want to also mention that crude oil, West Texas benchmark crude, fell 14 cents a barrel to settle at $50.55, and it's still above $50 a barrel. We always watch that number. And gold was down 2%, was the weakest level in 4 weeks, down to $1,293 an ounce.
Great. Thanks, Peter. Locally, the Bloomberg Boston Index up 0.25% today at 131.88. This report brought to you by Bentley University. Bentley's MBA graduates land great jobs with bigger challenges, higher satisfaction, and better salaries. A Bentley MBA can help you upgrade your pay grade. Bentley.edu/upgrade. Worth mentioning today, Woonsocket, Rhode Island-based CVS Health down 1.4%. The Pharmacy Benefit Management Unit announced today it will add broad restrictions to limit the amount of opioid drugs that patients can obtain. The restrictions will cap initial prescriptions for acute pain to a one-week supply. They'll also limit daily doses of morphine available for most patients with chronic pain. This is as of February 1st. So joining us now in studio is Carmen Ortiz, a former U.S. attorney and for the District of Massachusetts and now working in private practice. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Ann, Peter, good afternoon.
Thank you. And 7 years as U.S. attorney and the first Hispanic and appointed to that position.
Correct? And the first woman.
And the first woman, yeah. Well, we want to start with the news of the day and get your reaction to the attorney general's comments today at Moakley Courthouse. He talked about terrorism, the Boston bombings, but he also brought up a case that you just told us as you were coming in. You're very familiar with the one about the one on MS-13. What about that?
Well, I was delighted to hear, and it's great to get a terrific shout out the way the office did, quite frankly, on one of our top priorities and efforts in the office, which was battling organized crime. And at the top of that list was the MS-13 gang. And in January of 2016, we brought down a major sweep. We had a sweep in which many members of that gang and associates of that gang, including not only just members but top leaders of that gang here in Massachusetts and in other states of the country, were arrested and were charged with a series of different charges under the RICO statute and trafficking guns and, I believe, drugs at the time. But the most important thing about that case was that it was not only just a long-term investigation, it involved the collaboration of federal, state, and local law enforcement, police departments, and we helped the locals solve, I believe it was 5 murders of incredibly young people at the hands of one of the most brutal gangs that this country has seen, MS-13.
And the Attorney General made it clear that this mission, this prosecution, these cases were going to continue under the Trump administration and continue in a big way.
And they should. They should. I think that I know that one of the things that I talked about when we, as a result of the sweep and understanding the dangers of this gang, and that it was growing not just in Massachusetts at the time, and I think we made a humongous dent there, but it was growing in other parts of our country, that there should be a national effort among law enforcement to really attack the brutality of this gang. Because at the time, I almost I compared it to, you know, La Cosa Nostra. You know, of the, you know, the 60s and 70s back then.
But the Trump administration is also using this gang as an example of their decisions to crack down on deportations. And do you think that's fair?
I think that they may be using this to crack down on and say that all deportations are appropriate. The deportations that they were referring to today involving violent criminals, individuals with a criminal history, gang associations, and so forth, that had already been a top priority. We were deporting those kinds of individuals. So I think we need to be careful that we're not using the efforts on MS-13 and other brutal criminals that should be deported, have been deported, to just sweep everyone who may be illegally here in this country under a variety of different circumstances.
Well, but as you know, they have been detaining and arresting people with expired work visas, people who they have, a case of a Hispanic janitor at the local university. Are you saying that that is the law, right? I mean, they are enforcing the law. Do you disagree with that enforcement and what the administration is doing?
I think that immigration reform has been desperately needed for years and years and ignored. And to now respond by sweeping up, like you indicated, a janitor with children in this country. I think it was in Arizona, a woman who had committed, I believe may have been immigration fraud when she entered the country, but was working hard, had children in this country. She was deported and I think is now living in Mexico and her children are here in this country. I think that there has to be a different mechanism to deal with those individuals who are law-abiding citizens, have contributed to our country, and the results of deporting these individuals and breaking up families could have the unintended impact of really making our nation much less safer. This is not going to keep our communities safe because communities will be afraid to cooperate with law enforcement.
Path to citizenship from Congress of some kind.
There should be. Congress needs to look at the entire problem. There are all these different individuals in different circumstances, and they need to be resolved and they need to be tended to rather than just a general policy of sweeping everyone who may not be here legally.
What are your thoughts on the detainers issue and sanctuary cities? You know, whether local compliance should be with these federal mandates?
I don't want to just paint a broad brush and say that being a sanctuary city is completely appropriate. I think that you need to look at certain situations and circumstances. I think that you need to continue. Law enforcement at all the different levels from the local through the state and federal need to talk to one another. And I think that they need to be engaging with one another to make sure that they're all working together to do what's going to keep the community safe. And I'm not the sanctuary cities. I think cities need to protect their communities, but I think, I would like to know more of the details.
All right. Well, we'll continue this conversation. I'm Ann Mostu here with Peter Barnes and former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Carmen Ortiz, who has moved to the next chapter of her career. It's in the private sector at Anderson & Krager here in Boston and to Boston College. And now she's here in the Bloomberg studios. This is Bloomberg 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore. This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour. More with former U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz in a moment.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1061 Boston.
U.S. stocks declined today in metals dropped in the Fed's aftermath. I'm Ann Mostu in the Bloomberg 1061 newsroom in Boston's Financial District here with Peter Barnes. Coming up, more of our conversation with former U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz. But first, we're going to have a quick check of global markets with Peter.
That's right. In the major indexes, we're down today. The Dow Industrial is down 53. The S&P 500 down, fell 0.3%, and the NASDAQ down about 0.5%. Apple really getting hit hard today, Ann.
Thanks very much, Peter. And this segment brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith Incorporated, member SIPC. The Bloomberg Boston Index today up 0.25% at 131.88, a pretty good day for Boston businesses on Wall Street. So joining us now in studio is former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Carmen Ortiz, who has moved to the next chapter of her career. It's in the private sector at Anderson and Krieger here in Boston, and she's also teaching at Boston College.
Yeah, and we want to continue our discussion with her because we found out during the break some pretty interesting things about her personal life story. Your family came from Puerto Rico. You were born
in New
York. And so tell us a little bit about your personal story and then how you came to the law.
Well, I'm the oldest of five children. My parents are from Puerto Rico. And when I grew up, they really they only spoke Spanish, so that was my first language. And I, through school and watching TV, at that age time, I think instead of Law and Order, we watched Perry Mason.
Yeah.
So the drama of the courtroom really got me interested in becoming a lawyer. And so I knew early on when I was in high school that I thought it'd be great, be exciting, interesting to become a lawyer. And then as I got older and went to college, it reaffirmed it. I learned more about the law. I felt that I could help people. I could make a difference and have a profession that would really challenge me. And I have been very fortunate and blessed in my professional career.
And you have had some noteworthy cases, obviously, especially in the last few years. Let's start by talking about Whitey Bulger. What surprised you most about that trial, and what would you have done differently, if anything?
That's a good question. I think what surprised me the most,
yeah.
Now that I think about it and reflect about it, I think it surprised me as well as it surprised so many people in this community that he never testified at the trial. And for a long time, it seemed that, you know, he was just dying to get his story out and everyone was going to hear his story and his perspective on what had happened and his relationship with the government and so forth. It was part of the defense's opening statement that he would tell his story to the jury. And when time came, silence.
Yeah.
Crickets.
Mm-hmm. Did it make you nervous to sit there with him? I don't think anything makes you nervous.
No, a few things. But you're in a very secure courtroom. There are court officers around. And there's the lawyers are there, the judge is there, the clerk. And you have the public spectators. And this also did not surprise me, the involvement of the victims and their families. They were there day to day, not only in the live courtroom, but in the overflow courtrooms. That was amazing. They were constantly dedicated. It was a long trial, and it had taken a long time to see justice done.
Same question for the Tsarnaev case, the case of the Boston bomber. You prosecuted him. Any interesting, surprising takeaways on that case for you?
The surprise was that kind of an incident by a young man and his brother occurred here at all. That was the surprise, that this happened in our own backyard, this terrorist attack on our city, on our people, hurting such young people. That was the surprise. But I really want to take this opportunity to say that in both the Whitey case and the Tsarnaev case, the team of prosecutors and the law enforcement agents and officers that were involved were of such talent, professionalism, dedication, that quite frankly, when it got to the litigation phase, I thought everything went incredibly smoothly. But that's because of the expertise that we had coming from those teams.
And some of the families of the victims of the Marathon bombing wrote in saying they did not want the death penalty for Jahar Tsarnaev, including the family of the young boy, Martin Richard. How did you feel about that? I mean, were there conflicting feelings about the death penalty in this case?
There were definitely conflicting feelings among victims, survivors, and their families.
Right, but for you?
For me internally, I was conflicted in the sense that my heart went out to these families and victims. And I felt terrible that perhaps what they wanted to see happen wasn't happening, and they were already dealing with such tragic circumstances. So I was trying to be sensitive, thoughtful, but the process of the death penalty, it's a lengthy process that goes through many different levels of review, and it is only the Attorney General of the United States who makes the decision that the government will seek the death penalty. Right. After a tremendous amount of consideration and thought and levels of review. And the decision was made for a variety of different reasons that pertain to this case. And so I was hoping and trying my best to try to navigate the process so that hopefully they could understand that piece of it. They really couldn't control it. But, I have feelings, and my heart went out to them because they were already suffering from what they had endured, and to now not have the process go the way it would make it easier for them as they viewed it, really touched me and impacted me. But different victims and families wanted different things.
Right.
We have about a minute left. What advice, now that you're out after this long career public service, do you have now for your former colleagues in the law enforcement community, particularly at federal, on stopping terrorism, on national security? What would you give? What advice?
I would say that continue the fight in the same way that we have been doing at the office when I was there. I worked with prosecutors as well as law enforcement agents that work so hard, that care so much, and that are willing to work with one another to collaborate. And I think that's critical, and not just among themselves, but with the community.
But you have some concerns.
I have concerns that at this moment in time, with some of the messaging that's going out, especially through the administration, that's impacting our communities, that one critical piece of keeping the community safe is for law enforcement to work with communities, that the communities, some of the communities may not feel safe in speaking to law enforcement, and that could have really a negative impact in our ability, not our ability, but law enforcement's ability to keep them safe.
All right. With a front row seat to U.S. history, former U.S. Attorney Matt of Massachusetts, Carmen Ortiz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1061 Boston.
U.S. stocks fell from records today while treasuries and the dollar were mixed. I'm Ann Mostu in the Bloomberg 1061 newsroom in Boston's Financial District. Here with Peter Barnes coming up, it's officially symphony season. We're speaking with Mark Volpe of the Boston Symphony Orchestra to tell us what's ahead. But first, a check on global markets with Peter Barnes.
That's right, Ann. And all the major indexes were down today. The Dow Industrials breaking a 9-day winning streak, falling 53 points to close at 22,359. The S&P 500 index down 0.3% to about 2,500. The NASDAQ really got clobbered today, down 0.5%, closing at 64.22. Apple losing almost 2%, its lowest level since August 1st, on some concerns about the new iPhones.
Yeah, yes. Which one to buy seems to be the question on a lot of people's minds. This newscast is brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. And by that, I meant with Apple. There's a new phone out and another one coming in November, the iPhone
X. Some technical issues, apparently, though, that got investors spooked. So.
Yeah. Well, today, the Bloomberg Boston Index was up 0.25% at 131.88. Carbonite had a good day, up 3.8%. That's a Boston-based software security business. Muhammad Ali, who's the president and CEO of Carbonite, has been making many media appearances lately, including one on Bloomberg, to say he's worried about how immigration and H-1B1 restraints will hurt his business and the economy. So switching gears from the markets to music, we are joined on the phone by Mark Volpe, who's the managing director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Welcome, Mark. Tell us what's starting off tonight.
Well, actually, it's starting tomorrow night. We're obviously respecting
apologies.
The Jewish holiday tonight. But Friday, we have a all Bernstein tribute to open our season, and everyone knows that Bernstein had a long affiliation with New York and the Philharmonic, and wrote a few Broadway musicals worthy of note. But ultimately, he really had his beginnings here, born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and certainly was a product of Boston Latin and Harvard. And early on, he was in the first class at Tango, at first conducting class, certainly identified as one of the great, great talents on the horizon. And in fact, he started his career with a 40-year relationship with the Boston Symphony in Tanglewood, and his last concert on Earth in 1990 was with the Boston Symphony at Tanglewood with a Beethoven 7, a legendary Beethoven 7 performance. So we had a 40-plus-year relationship with one of the great geniuses of that century.
And Bernstein passed away in 1990, and next year would have been his 100th birthday, which is part of the reason why you're saluting him.
Well, and we're going to be celebrating the actual birthday at Tanglewood in a concert that will be telecast throughout the world. But we're kicking off the whole season with all Bernstein, and we'll be celebrating Lenny through the course of this season and then through Tanglewood, where he had a real, you know, real kind of the spiritual home of music for him. And he certainly did a concert for his 70th birthday, probably the longest concert PBS ever had. It's probably still going on. That was 30 years ago, and now we're going to probably be a little bit more efficient and not quite go that far. And again, this all starts with tomorrow night's performance, ending with the West Side Story, of course, the suite, but a few other pieces he wrote specifically for the Boston Symphony.
Now, you've been doing a lot in the past year, Mark Volpe, at the BSO and at the Pops, I should say, with John Williams tributes. Are there any that are continuing this year, or any sort of John Williams in the Pops later in the holiday season?
Well, John's omnipresent. I mean, he's sort of the soundtrack of our generation. So October 1st, we're going to be actually first time in our history performing with the Boston Symphony and Boston Pops on the same stage in Franklin Park, and launching a whole new initiative that we're doing. And ultimately, it's going to feature some of John's, surprise, surprise, it's going to be Andres leading Mahler and Keith Lockhart leading John's music. So we're thrilled to continue that tradition. And, of course, John will have, again, presence in the spring season in May and June. He's always here and conducting his film music. And Tanglewood, he spends a good part of the summer outside of L.A. with us at Tanglewood. And in fact, some of his, he basically conducts the orchestra and coaches students and just has this presence. But he's also working, on whether it's Star Wars or Harry Potter or something. It's kind of fun to watch him work and you get to see the movie, and before there's any music, and if you see Star Wars without music, it's not Star Wars.
Yeah, that's true, of course.
And so, regardless of what one of the seven you're talking about, so he's a key element. We've actually done a few soundtracks with him. We did the soundtrack for Schindler's List with Itzhak Perlman. We did the soundtrack for Saving Private Ryan. So we've had the great privilege of not only doing a lot of John's music in concert, but actually laying down a track for a movie.
So the season kicks off tomorrow night for the BSO. You have the free concert in Franklin Park on October 1st, but we are a business show and a business station. I want to ask about the business of the BSO. You've been there now for 20 years. I was reading your remarkable job on the finances of the BSO. And, of course, Anne was telling me her growing up with the BSO. I grew up with classical music myself in Philadelphia. Eugene Ormandy, the Philadelphia Orchestra. I used to skip school to go listen to him practice. And, of course, Leonard Bernstein was a big part of my childhood. My mom made us watch all those concerts at the National New York Philharmonic. How are the finances of the – we have a bias, and we will admit it. We want to seek classical music grow and flourish, and particularly the BSO. So
talk about
the finances and how the symphony is doing and your job.
Yeah. You have a personal bias, and then full disclosure, you very graciously, Bloomberg is carrying our July 4th show throughout the world.
With the Pops
people there
partnership,
on the Pops on July 4th, that and had a great first year with our partners in Bloomberg. But, the orchestra business is not without challenge. We are very fortunate in that we have a sizable endowment that's somewhere around $470 million. You saw me, the market just went down. So, but obviously that changes day to day. But that aside, we also have physical assets like no other orchestra in the world, because we have not only Symphony Hall but in a few surrounding buildings, but we have 530 acres in the Berkshires and 100 structures of varying sizes, and so we are very, very fortunate, and that's a blessing and a curse, because the blessing is we have these assets, and the curse is we have to continue supporting our physical plants and obviously providing support for this incredible orchestra. And we have probably the most diverse set of brands. If you think, we were talking about the New York Philharmonic, great orchestra, but they don't even own a hall. I mean, they play at Lincoln Center in a hall owned by Lincoln Center. We have Symphony Hall as a brand. We have the Boston Symphony as a brand. Not to get in the marketing vernacular, we have the Boston Pops as a brand. We have the Tanglewood Festival as a brand, and then the school, which we were talking about, Lenny Bernstein earlier. He came out of the school there. He was in the first class in 1940. And so we have a myriad of brands and a degree of complexity and the scale of operation that no other orchestra in the world can really match.
We're speaking with Mark Volpe, Managing Director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Mark, how is the build-out? This last question, we have just about a minute and a half. How is the build-out going with Tanglewood right now and the expansion project?
Well, you're kind to ask. We broke ground. We're obviously putting in the foundation, and so it'll take about 15, 16 months. If you can tell me what the weather's going to be like in the Berkshires in January, February. And so it'll be, as we celebrate Lenny next summer, the following summer, the summer of 19, we're going to be launching 4 new buildings, 3 pavilions that'll house music and a new learning institute, and then 1 for food, because there's always a correlation between food and music, and as we know, and then we have the gestalt of nature on top of that at Tanglewood. So it's going great. The money's been raised to build it, and we're still raising some money to endow it, because it's obviously that's part of our ethos here, so we're excited. A lot of very positive developments here at Boston as well as Tanglewood.
Mark, before you go, just got to ask what your favorite Lenny Bernstein piece is. Can't let you get away without answering that.
I had the privilege of meeting him on numerous occasions, and it's got to be West Side Story. I mean, it's one of the most perfect pieces of music ever written. And of course, we're gonna play the dances, of course, as part of our concert on Friday.
Yeah, and we miss him. Real quick, what's going on with ticket prices and things like that?
It's pretty, we incrementally increase prices, but it's barely the inflation. So I think we have expensive tickets, but we also make it affordable. We have tickets for people under 40, $20 for the most part. We have rush on certain nights where you can get in for $9-$10, and so we try to have pretty significant range of prices from $10 up to $100 or whatever.
Keep the audiences going. Yeah.
Yeah, keep the audiences coming. And especially providing young people an opportunity to experience the power of music.
Thank you so much, Mark Volpe, Managing Director of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, starting their season tomorrow.
And I'll be going, Ann.
Good for you, Peter.
Absolutely.
You're really embracing the Boston nightlife.
And you are listening to Bloomberg 106.1 Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 in Metro West on the South Shore.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour.